National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Leo XIV is almost at his 100th day as Supreme Pontiff, and Catholics are looking back at his first months and looking ahead to the next steps of his pontificate. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Register Senior Editor Jonathan Liedl with his analysis. And then, the canonizations of Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati are only weeks away in Rome. We hear from CNA Rome correspondent for Catholic News Agency, Courtney Mares, who also happens to be an expert on Carlo Acutis. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. Shannon Mullen, my co-host, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, is off this week. Well, it's hard to imagine that Pope Leo XIV was elected 3 months ago, especially as it seems to many that he has settled into the papacy with such striking serenity and ease. What are we to make of these first months of the Leonine pontificate, and what can we anticipate, or at least guess, lies ahead in the coming months? I'm joined by Jonathan Liedl, Register Senior Editor, who has been following the new pope and his papacy from the very beginning. Jonathan, welcome.
Great to be with you, Matthew.
Let's go back a couple of months to May 8th, 2025. What was your reaction to the election of Robert Francis Cardinal Prevost as Pope Leo XIV?
Well, I think the immediate reaction, I think a number of us, because he was elected very quickly in the process. And so at first, I think there was surprise, right? People had thought that Cardinal Parolin, the Secretary of State of the Vatican, if there was going to be a quick election, he would be the guy. Just because he was such a well-known figure. But I think what we quickly discovered, especially as we began to hear stories of different cardinals representing maybe different wings of the church, if you will, playing a part in electing Pope Leo, is that he was seen as a unifying figure, right? He was seen as this figure who, you know, just his background, right? He's both an American from Chicago, but also spent many of his formative years in the priesthood in Chiclayo and other parts of Peru, right? So unifying, you know, these different hemispheres. And then also as an Augustinian, someone who lived in community, led that religious community across the world. And I think what, you know, long been said that it'd be impossible for there to be an American pope. Mm-hmm. But I think if there were to be a first one, I think Pope Leo XIV is kind of the perfect model for it, because he's, of course, an American. He doesn't shy away from speaking in English or, you know, posing with a White Sox hat or anything like that.
Or but getting also a deep dish pizza.
True, right? That just recently he got a deep dish pizza from his favorite pizza joint back home in the south side of Chicago. But at the same time, because he's been out of the country for so long, almost seen by many figures as sort of a very much someone who can represent the universal church in a way as well. So I think that was something that really struck us initially, is the number of, you know, like Cardinal Supich to Cardinal Burke, right? Very different American cardinals representing sort of maybe different priorities in the church, but both seeming pleased with his election. And then I think the gestures Pope Leo makes very early on in his pontificate, right? The very first one, arguably, is picking the name Leo XIV, right? Which is to go to say, hey, I'm just one successor among Peter of many. I'm going to take a name that's already been used 13 times. Francis, of course, had been a trailblazer in some ways, but Pope Leo, with that name indication and then wearing the traditional mozzetta when he stepped out on the loggia, almost tried to tell us from the get-go, like, this might be I'm going to be less about shaking things up, and I'm going to be maybe more about bringing things back together, which after the Francis pontificate, which was definitely a disruptive and somewhat a papacy full of many surprises and as Pope Francis' own word, making a mess to some extent, seems to be where we're at with Pope Leo right now.
Yeah, you've used the phrase in some of your writings that Pope Francis was a pope in a hurry. Mm. And it seems quite remarkable that if we were to use many, many interesting adjectives for Pope Leo XIV, hurried isn't one of them.
Mm, absolutely. That's brilliant. Yeah, I really liked what you said, his serenity and at ease, just someone who seems to have sort of settled into the papacy and is in no rush to sort of rock the boat or do anything dramatic, right? And I, you know, I was just thinking, you know, the 100 days is kind of a symbolic time when anyone steps into a new office, whether it's in politics or in the church, to sort of look at what have they done so far and what does this tell us about what might be coming, you know, further ahead. You know, Pope Francis, within his first 100 days, did things like, you know, his comment about a priest who might struggle with same-sex attraction, where he said, "Who am I to judge?" Right, and that reverberated throughout his 12-plus year papacy. Right, the symbolic gesture of Francis on the Holy Thursday liturgy, washing the feet, breaking the kind of norm, and washing the feet of women and Muslims during that liturgy. So Francis was very early on sort of signaled this kind of, hey, I'm going to do things a little bit differently here. And I think Leo, you're right, is not in a hurry. And part of that might be he's only 69 years old, so he has probably a long papacy ahead of him. And also, I don't know what your experience has been, Matthew, but I think covering the church, like during some of the Francis years, it did always seem like things were kind of in flux. It was hard to know sort of like, you know, where you can kind of put your feet down for a couple of minutes, because things were kind of moving and shifting. And I think Pope Leo is maybe providing a kind of counterbalance to that experience and just letting all of us sort of settle, and his leadership and his disposition really is providing for that right now.
Yeah, he, in many of his homilies and addresses, references, quotes Pope Francis, as mm-hmm. one would expect him to do. But he also, mm-hmm. Quite significantly, quotes so many of the recent popes. I think of John Paul II, Benedict in particular, mm-hmm. Paul VI, John the 23rd. How important does it seem to you that he is stressing this continuity?
Yeah, I think it's important for a number of reasons. I think one of them, something that happened with Pope Francis, if you looked at some of his encyclicals or his major speeches, a pattern was that they often didn't reference popes who had come right before him all too often, or at least not as much as had been typical with an encyclical. Like oftentimes when a papal encyclical comes along, there's a great attempt to sort of show how, hey, I'm the Pope now and I'm saying this right now, but it's really I'm pulling together what's already been said and presenting it. Francis somewhat went away from that. So I think for Leo to return to that, it's what I would say is one of these gestures that he's undertaking right now to really try to present himself as a Pope for the whole church, right? And especially those who might have been sort of felt a little disenfranchised during the Francis pontificate, maybe more conservative or traditional Catholics. And between the liturgical gestures, you know, the vestments he wears, the fact that he sings so beautifully, you know, in Latin, the Regina Caeli, that he celebrates mass with such reverence, there seem to be these gestures in those areas. You're right, in his speeches, in his addresses, kind of fusing together these past papacies to sort of say, hey, I'm, you know, like I'm not playing favorite, so to speak. And you know, I think a real question will be, okay, are these gestures going to translate? What kind of concrete actions are they going to translate in terms of church unity? Because he hasn't made many major appointments in terms of who he wants to head different dicasteries in the Roman Curia, especially who he'll pick to succeed him as the prefect of the Dicastery of Bishops. You know, his next encyclical, his first encyclical, we don't know for sure what it is yet. We don't know what he'll emphasize in his teaching ministry. So we at least have these gestures, and we'll see how they translate into maybe concrete unity building actions through his appointments or his priorities.
Yeah, as you say, he's got some very interesting and important decisions coming up. The curial appointments, he's got a lot of his prefects who are going to be over 75. Some are approaching 80, mm-hmm. so we're going to see a sea change. You have a lot of what the technical term is superannuated major dioceses and archdioceses around the world. I think, for example, in the United States, you have Chicago, you have New York, a number of other places. So those appointments are going to mm-hmm. tell us a lot. And you
Absolutely.
Also mentioned, the other decisions that he's going to have to make, two that seem to be looming. The first is he going to do something on the traditional Latin Mass? There seems to be mm-hmm. continuing controversy and division in the church on that. especially in a pontificate that's dedicated to unity. And then the other one that I want to talk to you about is synodality. We've had a few hints from him, but nothing that was really significant.
Yeah, yeah. The cards are still close to the chest. I mean, what's interesting on the traditional Latin Mass front, I guess you're right. We have the restrictions of Traditionis Custodis, which were put in place by Francis, continue to be implemented in places like Charlotte, in places like Detroit. But then we have allowances being made in San Angelo, Texas, for instance, that they can still celebrate the traditional Latin Mass in the parish church. And then a really interesting thing happened just yesterday, earlier this week. It was Cardinal Koch, who's the prefect of the Dicastery for Christian Unity. And he, in an interview, I think it was with German Catholic media, he said Pope Francis' approach to the traditional Latin Mass was very restrictive, and he hopes that Leo does something to open the door more. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because this is a prefect, right? Like a very high-ranking curial figure who didn't really speak out publicly like this during the Francis pontificate, but yet in the early days of Leo feels like he can kind of express this opinion. And so I think what we're seeing thus far is Pope Leo has not come in and sort of rescinded Pope Francis's restrictions, but he also hasn't come in, and it's not clear, at least, that he has demanded that they be enforced in the same way it appeared was happening in the latter years of the Francis pontificate. So I don't know, Matthew. I don't know which way he's going to go for sure, but right now, at least, he seems content to sort of let things play out at a local level without intervening too much. We'll see how sustainable that is in the long run, but we don't know. And I think on synodality, we certainly know that Pope Leo, I mean, on his very first address, when right after he was elected Pope, he spoke of the church as a synodal church. So anyone who thought that synodality was not going to have a single moment after the Francis pontificate, I think the reality is that Pope Leo certainly appears to want the synodal process, which we have another three-year phase culminating with a big Vatican event in 2028. Pope Leo seems to want that to continue. He speaks about synodality, but I think we don't know necessarily what synodality will exactly mean for him. And I think the fact that he's a canon lawyer, and he will know what the canonical structure is, how the church is governed right now. I think if there are any changes or if he says, well, no, we're not doing that kind of change, his background suggests that he'll sort of know how to maneuver that and implement it, maybe in a way that Francis was kind of more opening something up. But I think, again, we don't know exactly what Pope Leo, what his understanding of synodality is or how he wants to move it forward in the church. So,
well, I know we're all going to be following it. Yeah, exactly. We're going to be following it very closely, and I look forward to your additional reporting on this. Jonathan, a great conversation as always.
Thank you, Matthew. Likewise.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. When we come back, we talk with Courtney Mares, CNA Rome correspondent, as Rome prepares for the upcoming canonizations of Blessed Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati. Stay tuned to Register Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, your host. Flying solo this week, as noted, Shannon Mullen, the editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, and my co-host here, is off this week. Well, on September 7th, tens of thousands are expected in Rome for the canonizations of Blessed Carlo Acutis and Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati. How are the preparations going, and what do we need to know about these two extraordinary young saints? We're joined by CNA Rome correspondent Courtney Mares, who is also, happily, the author of Carlo Acutis, A Saint in Sneakers, a biography that I highly, highly recommend, especially in preparation for the upcoming canonizations. Courtney, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you, Matthew. It's always such a joy to be here with you.
Well, it's been such a winding road, hasn't it, to get to these canonizations. I know we're still some weeks off, but I do have the sense internationally that there is this growing excitement.
Yes, definitely. There is so much excitement and anticipation leading up to this canonization. not only here in Rome, where it's greatly anticipated as the first canonization of Pope Leo XIV's pontificate, but also across the globe. We just had the Jubilee of Youth here in Rome, and I was speaking with young Catholic pilgrims from Australia to Latin America who have been eagerly awaiting this canonization. And it's also just been a joy to see in the years it's been leading up to this moment, we've seen both Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio inspiring new apostolates, new Catholic schools, new digital evangelization initiatives. I was just speaking with a young man who is on a Jubilee pilgrimage here to Rome, who told me that hearing the story of Carlo Acutis inspired him to start going to daily Mass for the first time in his life and to deepen his faith. And I'm just so excited to see how this canonization will be an opportunity for even more people to discover their stories and to be inspired.
Yeah, both of them are really models for young people, but they're models for any Catholic, given that we hold up these saints as role models, however old or young you are. But is there a sense that, and we never want to make comparisons, but Carlo Acutis seems to be a little better known than Pier Giorgio Frassati?
It seems that Carlo Acutis has really gone viral, which I don't think is a coincidence, given his aptitude for computer programming, and you imagine his intercession from above. He's been able to help spread his story and his witness to the real presence of the Eucharist in this kind of viral way on social media and online, and it's beautiful to see how digital communications that he loved are being used to spread the story of a saint. But I will say, during the Jubilee of Youth, I think more young people had the opportunity to literally encounter Frassati.
I was going to ask you about that.
because his incorrupt body was brought from Turin, Italy, down to Rome, and it was available for veneration in his casket for the entirety of the Jubilee of Youth. So I wouldn't be surprised if, we go into the canonization with more people recognizing Frassati and his story as well.
Yeah, that was a pretty extraordinary moment, wasn't it, in Santa Maria Sopra Minerva? Especially, I've seen images, and I'm sure you were there, of that remarkable proximity of Pier Giorgio with the tomb of Catherine of Siena, both of them having those distinct Dominican ties.
Yeah. Literally, his casket was placed just in front of the tomb of St. Catherine of Siena. And when I visited the Basilica of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, it was standing room only. I mean, it was completely packed with young people. And it was just beautiful to see. I did some interviews with some of the people who were there to pray. And there was a 16-year-old girl who told me, she was just like, she was so visibly emotional. She's like, I got to touch, the casket of Pier Giorgio and to pray. And she said that was just such a powerful moment for her.
Yeah. And talk about your own journey here. You are the author of a book on Carlo Acutis. This is, having attended some canonizations myself of saints who had a particular devotion and importance in my life, like Damian de Wooster and Kateri Tikaquita, I've always equated it to feeling like you're going to their graduation. What has this been like for you, especially to know that this canonization is so close?
Yeah, it's incredible for me. When I first started working on my biography of Carlo Acutis was just after his beatification in 2020. And at that time, I was pretty sure Carlo was going to be canonized someday, and I hoped it would be in my lifetime, but you never can be sure. And to have it come so quickly and while I'm based here in Rome has been such a joy, and I can't wait. It's been beautiful this summer, kind of in the months leading up to the canonization. I've had a chance to return to the hometowns of both Carlo Acutis and Pier Giorgio Frassati, and travel with a team of our reporters here from EWTN to prepare some more content to share with the world of their stories, where they're from, and prepare some pilgrimage guides for the EWTN travel app for for people that were expecting to travel to Italy during the Jubilee year. And so it's been fun. You know, I learned a lot about Carlo while writing the book, but it's been fun to go even deeper into the lives of these two holy young men and share them in multimedia forms.
That's right. So you just mentioned the Jubilee for Youth. What was that experience like? Because I think a lot of people were surprised that we had a million young people showing up, especially at the Tor Vergata.
Yeah, I mean, the Jubilee of Youth was, wow. It was such a powerful moment. I get emotional just thinking about it. We had 1 million young people adoring the Eucharist together with our Holy Father in Tor Vergata, where Pope Leo personally carried the cross through the crowd. I mean, it really did feel like a World Youth Day event. And over the past week, I interviewed young people from the U.S., Lebanon, Mexico, South Korea, Syria, Vietnam, Australia. I mean, so many places. And all of these young people were so on fire for their faith. And it really gave me personally a lot of hope to encounter that. Now, I must share also my firsthand perspective that Rome was a bit chaotic and loud with so many young people packed into one place. I mean, the people living in Rome, or, you know, people who were tourists visiting Rome, could not avoid the fact that this Jubilee was happening. I mean, you saw Jubilee pilgrims everywhere you went, all over the city. And young people, especially the Spanish pilgrims, are always chanting, "Esta es la juventud del Papa." And I don't know if I'll ever get that stuck out of my head, because I heard it just so much everywhere you went.
And for those who don't speak the language, what was that? What were they saying?
Oh, they're saying, you know, this is the youth of the Pope. You know, kind of just like, we are here and we are here united with the Holy Father. So it's a beautiful chant to hear all over the city. And you know, there were some challenges for the young pilgrims. All of them were camped out overnight in this field. And of course, it started raining at one point in the middle of the night.
It wouldn't be a World Youth Day without rain, right?
Yeah, everyone was woken up by the rain. And other than that, there were other time moments where it was really hot. But, you know, that made it kind of part of that penitential aspect of the pilgrimage. But yeah, there were just also a lot of opportunities for prayer amid the chaos of the large crowds. In particular, there were so many side events kind of happening all throughout the Eternal City beyond the official schedule. And I was delighted to take advantage of the fact that there were more than 50 missionaries of charity who had come to Rome for the Jubilee of Youth and were sharing the story of Mother Teresa and with a new generation. And so I took advantage of that opportunity to spend some time with them for an article that I wrote that featured, you know, the MC's unique style of youth outreach at the Jubilee, which was really a joy for me.
Yeah, and the image, and this goes back also to World Youth Days, of having a million young people who grow absolutely silent at the consecration. Or at those moments of adoration. I know a lot of people in secular media have commented on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the witness of that just speaks for itself. It was so powerful. And the fact that you have now, with Pope Leo XIV, this pope who just moves seamlessly between three languages, speaking in English, speaking in Spanish, speaking in Italian. And with that skill that he possesses, he was able to speak directly to the hearts of so many of the young people in that crowd, which was really beautiful. I know for me, one of my favorite moments actually happened right at the beginning of the Jubilee, right after the opening mass here in St. Peter's Square. Pope Leo actually wasn't supposed to be at the mass, but he surprised the young pilgrims in the Pope Mobile after the mass, and then appeared before, you know, spoke powerfully before the crowd in English and said, "Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. Mm-hmm. You are the light of the world." And it was just, wow, I got chills just in that moment. It was really beautiful.
He really does, in a very serene, kind of calm, quiet way, connect with young people, doesn't he?
Definitely. Yeah, he's a very thoughtful and very intentional with what he speaks. But we've also seen him, you know, getting out there in the moment and speaking loudly and energetically, and that's been a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah. Well, Courtney, as always, I love your coverage, and I send everybody to the Catholic News Agency for your stories, your reporting, and also at ncregister.com. I want to give a quick shout-out to a piece that you just did on public veneration of soon-to-be Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati's body illustrates that holy relics are not, quote, just a quirky Catholic thing. That's a must-read, as is your book, Heading into the Canonization. Great to have you on.
Thank you, Matthew.
Well, that's it for this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us here on Register Radio. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care, and God bless.